You are listening to WPVMLP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina.
From Feature Story News in Brussels, I'm William Denslow. Forensic investigators are combing through the wreckage of a Bangkok pub, where a fire killed at least 27 people late Sunday night. Officials say smoke inhalation is believed to be the main cause of death, with many of the victims found trapped at the rear of the venue, where there were no fire escapes. Laura Westbrook reports from Hong Kong.
The Prime Minister saying that smoke filled the room and that in the confusion, many of the victims had sought refuge and sought shelter in toilets in the back of the building. And officials saying that is where many of the victims were found.
Iran's Revolutionary Guard says it struck American military facilities in Bahrain, Kuwait and Oman Monday, expanding its retaliatory attacks across the Gulf for a second consecutive day. Comes as the US Central Command says it launched a fresh wave of strikes on Iranian air defense systems, radar sites and missile capabilities on Sunday evening. Tehran says its operations are aimed solely at US military targets, while Washington says it's downgraded Iran's offensive capabilities. Fiona Mee reports from Dubai.
This is now the second consecutive day of Iranian retaliatory strikes on Gulf territory. And the sense here is that Kuwait, Bahrain and Oman are firmly on the front line of that confrontation. That Iran assists is aimed only at US military targets. And the IRGC says it's carrying out phased eye-for-eye operations, firing missiles and drones at what it calls installations and infrastructure.
European foreign ministers are gathering in Brussels to discuss a 21st round of Russian sanctions and whether to impose a trade ban on Israeli settlers. Meanwhile, members of the Coalition of the Willing are gathering in Paris to discuss ongoing support for Ukraine. Top of the agenda for Kyiv is air defences. Officials say their stockpiles are running low as Russian aerial bombardments have intensified. Russ Cullen reports from Paris.
Donald Trump saying that the US could give Ukraine a license to build Patriot air defence systems inside Ukraine, but the Ukrainian government urging more immediate support as well. We could see on Monday an agreement from some of the members of the Coalition of the Willing to give air defence systems immediately to help protect Ukrainian cities. We've seen Russia step up its campaign with deadly strikes on Ukrainian cities, including the capital Kyiv in recent weeks, just as Ukraine is also stepping up its disruption campaign and sabotage tactics on the Crimean Peninsula and further long-range drone strikes inside Russia.
And the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says a proposal to limit children's access to social media will be presented later this year. It comes as a number of European nations are looking into similar measures. Von der Leyen says her call for stronger protections is based on evidence provided by a special panel on child safety online. From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks, looking today and tomorrow at the arrival of the Bayeux Tapestry in London. It is back on UK soil for the first time in a millennium. It's an embroidered cloth, 230 feet long, about 20 inches high, that is usually on permanent display in Bayeux in Normandy. It depicts 58 separate scenes of events that led up to the Norman conquest in 1066. The tapestry itself dates from not long after the Battle of Hastings, and is believed to have been made in England and presented as a gift to William the Conqueror. Lord Peter Ricketts is the UK government's special envoy overseeing the loan of the tapestry by the British Museum.
One of the reasons it's been possible to bring it now is because of the Channel Tunnel, which means it can come on dry land. So the issue was to design a very high-tech container to minimize the vibrations, to keep the climate absolutely the same all the way, and then to drive it in one journey from Bayeux down to Calais on the shuttle, out at Folkestone and up to the museum. And having planned it very carefully, having kept the timing and date quite discreet because we didn't want it to be disturbed or disrupted in any way, it arrived pretty much on schedule in its container.
Tomorrow, why he thinks so many people are so excited about seeing the tapestry when it goes on temporary display at the British Museum in September.
The main news again. Forensic investigators are combing through the wreckage of a Bangkok pub, where an explosive fire killed 27 people late on Sunday night. Iran says it struck American military facilities in Bahrain, Kuwait and Oman Monday, expanding its retaliatory attacks across the Gulf for a second consecutive day. And European foreign ministers are gathering in Brussels to discuss a 21st round of Russian sanctions and whether to impose a trade ban on Israeli settlers. And that's the latest feature story news. William Denslow reporting.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Showers and thunderstorms over the next 2 days. High temperatures will reach the mid to upper 70s, with overnight lows in the lower 60s. By Wednesday, just a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms late in the afternoon. Mostly sunny, the high 87. For Wednesday night, mostly clear, a low going down to 65. The heat gets turned on Thursday, sunny, the high near 90. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville, 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us again on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts across the country sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WPVM 103.7, the voice of Asheville, independent commercial-free radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant and behavioral health expert. Joining us today is our distinguished guest and friend of mine, Dr. John Santopietro. Dr. Santopietro is the Senior Vice President at Hartford Healthcare and Physician-in-Chief at their Behavioral Health Network there in Hartford, Connecticut, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, and Assistant Professor at the Frank H. Netter MD School of Medicine, Quinnipiac University. John got his BA at Yale, but he went on to get his MD from Northwestern Medical School in Chicago. He did his internship and residency at Cambridge Hospital with that little school up there in Mass. What's the name of it? Harvard? Yeah, that's the one. He also did a fellowship with Austin Riggs Center, a residential therapeutic community up in Stockbridge, Mass., probably the place where he and Virgil crossed paths at one point. Dr. Santopietro is a 2001 diplomat with the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, and he retains his certification and license in multiple states there in the Northeast, but keeps it up in North Carolina as well, having been former chief clinical officer at the chair of, and chair of Department of Psychiatry at the Carolinas Healthcare System in Charlotte, but we won't hold that against him. John has many such leadership appointments across the Northeast, including former president and medical director at Silver Hill Hospital over there with our friends in New Canaan. Just had Dr. Murata on the show. Dr. Santopietro is a distinguished fellow with the American Psychiatric Association, member of the Connecticut Psychiatric Society, and the American Medical Association, former board member at the American Association of Community Psychiatrists, also member of the Group of, for the Advancement of Psychiatry, and the American Association of Psychiatric Administrators. Doc, welcome to the show.
Wow, that was way too long. So, you know, I'm like, who is that guy?
Who's this guy we're talking about? Well, you know, the thing that I like to say is he's also just like a nice guy and I like hanging out with him.
It's kind of like, imagine like those, if you know, you're about to like, you know, they say your life flashes before your eyes when you're like get in a car accident or something. Like, that's what I'm like, who is that guy? And actually, I just recently, since that bio, my APA, American Psychiatric Association status has moved to Distinguished Life Fellow, which means that I'm old.
Congratulations. Well, which means that you're old.
No, that's the only, the qualification is you've been in it for 30 years. So, well, anyway, I don't think of myself that old. So I am, you know, it's a total honor here, Todd, to be, you know, able to have a conversation with you. And for a variety of reasons, most importantly, I think we get up every day and have a hard time sleeping at night because of some of the same things. You know, when I first met you, I could tell those, you know, people that are in the field listening know, and those hopefully about to enter the field will know that many of us kind of get bitten by a bug that that really changes our life. So I thought maybe, I don't know if it's okay, just saying a little bit about how I ended up, you know, getting into the,
well, that's a story I haven't heard. I'd love to hear your story. Like, where, you know, what, where did the bug bite you? You know, I guess is the question.
Well, and it's, I don't know if I would have been able to answer that, like, you know, 20 years ago, but looking back, here's how I think of it. So I grew up in Rhode Island, which is a very small state, obviously, and I'm all Italian. If people that have been in Rhode Island might know, there are a lot of Italian people in Rhode Island. So I nobody's not Italian in my family until me. My wife is actually all Irish. And and it was a very tight family. And when I say it was a close family, three of the brothers, one, two, three, married three sisters. One, two, three sisters.
No kidding.
From across the street.
Right.
And so
that's how it was in the old country, you know, essentially.
That's how it was. And they, what they did was they had a fish market, and that was the family business that they started. And so I grew up working in a fish market since I was like a little kid. And so I was always around a lot of people, and people were always talking and kind of in each other's business. And we'd have big gatherings and holidays and stuff. So I was interested in how, and you meet a lot of interesting people working in a fish market. I don't know if you want a lot of different personality types to observe, it's a great way. And so, so then my mother, my parents were both teachers. They were the first generation to go to college, and they believed in education. And so my mother taught at a private school so we could go for free back in the day. And that was a Quaker school. And I don't know if people know much about Quakers, but they're very inward looking. So, and I went to this school, the one school, from kindergarten through high school. So 13 years in one school. And they're, we would have silent meeting once a month, even when you're just a little kid, like in kindergarten.
I'm a big fan of Parker Palmer, who's, you know, kind of takes the Quaker method and uses it as a, you know, this introspective way of doing development work. It's cool stuff, but I'm very familiar with the Quaker method. Yeah, it's neat stuff.
I'm going to have to check that out. Like, meaning in the work, like in our work?
Yeah, and with educators and with, you know, care providers, he you can imagine that he aligns to folks that are in care and teaching professions. Courage to teach, courage to heal. You know, Parker Palmer's neat stuff, but the method that he uses is the Quaker method. And I think it's really cool. It's neat that you grew up that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And literally, so even, you know, these silent meetings for an hour. And however many that added up to,
yeah,
you know, my whole education. And you're in a room with, you could, you know, I don't know, 50 people, maybe sometimes 100, more than that, 100 people. And nobody's in charge of the meeting. Anybody can speak. So it's a very intense sort of, it's sort of like group therapy. So, you know, I was sort of primed to do something in mental health. And then when I was in college, I took a course on Sigmund Freud, you know, and when I was a sophomore. And that was it. I was just blown away. And I'm like, wow, there's an unconscious and you can help people by talking to them. And then I went to medical school and all that stuff, always thinking I'd be a psychiatrist or do something in mental health. And finished all that training that you described in 2000. And my first job.
I left the dates out because I didn't want to date you too bad, you know.
It's like, I can't believe what's going on. Anyway, I mean, we have three boys, and the two, one's about to graduate from college, and one's a freshman in college, and one's in high school. So, and I was just planning on being a clinician, which the just is in quotations, because that is to this day my favorite thing to do. It's what brings me the most, in a sense, joy and satisfaction. But what happened was my first job was in an inner city hospital just outside of Boston in Dorchester. And I basically couldn't believe how broken the system was. And I couldn't unsee that. And so the way I described it is I was just afflicted with, I couldn't stay out of the fight to make things better, meaning getting involved in leadership. And so I'm kind of a reluctant leader in a sense. Like, it was not my first thing that I wanted to do, but every day that I feel like I can make a difference as a leader and help move things incrementally forward. And so that's been it for 25 years now. And I've been I really worked in like 12 systems, and which is a whole other story. But at the end of the day, community mental health, state hospital, inner city hospital, community hospital, Silver Hill, you mentioned, North Carolina, Maine, Massachusetts, Connecticut. So I have a pretty good sense of the system and what's out there. And right now, the role that I'm in, which I've been in for over 6 years, which is a total record for me, is is this leading behavioral health at Hartford Healthcare, which is a not-for-profit here, system health system in Connecticut. We have 47,000 employees in the whole organization, 3,000 in behavioral health, which is really unusual. And to have that many in a big system, in a big healthcare system.
In a nonprofit system that maintains its nonprofit and it hasn't been bought by some other system, which has happened to our system as well, you know, here in Asheville. But I mean, I think that some of the other things that you're doing, some pretty innovative stuff around community mental health. You've got a new recovery center that just opened, the Ridge Recovery Center. You've, you know, got your irons in a lot of fires or a lot of irons in the fire, some of which have come out and are serving the community in ways that are really incredible. I was responding to something. Somebody asked a series of questions and I was responding, I think it was on LinkedIn or somewhere, but I said, you know, the thing that we need to do, people talk about a broken system. I'm like, I'm not sure when it was functional, but we do have these I don't know what state of functionality we came from where we would say that it was broken, but we do have these pockets. There are these places, and I would say that you and your role and the work that you're doing is one of them, where there is exceptional work being done, where there's real solid community work and solid treatment that's happening in a format that is, you know, welcoming and, you know, makes people feel a part of something and causes them to stay invested and engaged. In the country, little spots here and there. And I think we just need to find those models and do more of them in places where we can plant them. What, like, in your mind, you know, you've always had this, you wanted to be a clinician and you went and got an education and everything. It sounds to me like the bug bit you when you got inside of the system and saw how broken it was and decided to make some changes. That's where the bug bit you. And then you can't let it go. So in your mind, what work have you done that you think we need more of, and or what do you see for the future in terms of bringing our mental health and behavioral health care system back into a place where we feel like it serves the people that are in greatest need?
Yeah, that's really a fantastic question, honestly. And we could probably spend a week talking about
that. Yeah, we've spent a long time.
but
give me the highlights, you know.
Well, here's the, you know, my mind goes in two directions on that. You know, one is sort of the rocket science side, and one is the not rocket science side. So I'll start with the non rocket science side. And this has to do with my, you know, connecting with you years ago. And when you see people who get how important it is to connect with other human beings in this work. I mean, I can't overstate that. What at the end of the day, as of today, there is no blood test. There is no head scan. There is nothing that says this person has bipolar disorder or this person has PTSD in terms of an actual physical, you know, lab value, right? Which is amazing, right? If you have pneumonia, you know, we get a sputum sample. We find out what bacteria it is. We can tell within, you know,
we can see your white blood cell count. We know that you're et cetera, right?
Genes, you know, cancer, all this stuff. So at the end of the day, what we do is imprecise. You know, it doesn't have precision, but doesn't mean we're not good at it. We can be really good at it. And you know this as well as I do, that there's a difference between when it's being done really well and when it's not being done so well. And I think about that in terms of like clinical soul. You can sort of tell that there's sort of clinical soul in an organization and in individuals. I would say actually the irony, and I've been doing this for a long time. I probably, you know, I mean, I have 3,000 people here. I don't know how many people across the years I've had on my teams, but it's thousands, right? Mm. I can't think of almost any of them that didn't start out as like caring, you know, loving, you know, bright people that want to make a difference and help other people. So where it goes wrong is usually in the system. Like they start that way.
Yeah.
But it's within a system that starts for whatever, and again, the system doesn't intend to do this, and you know, but for whatever reason, there's too much emphasis on throughput and productivity or all this paperwork
or caseload.
Now, the other side of it is we do have access issues. So I'm definitely a fan, and I do see as many patients still as I actually can because I love it. But on the other side of it is this is, again, all in the non-rocket science bucket. And the other way I would describe this is basically there's two things we do when people come into our services. We either are trying to understand them or we're trying to manage stuff. Right. Manage stuff is you come in with a symptom, we give you medicine. You come in, you know, and I work, we have 337 inpatient beds. You know, you have an aggressive behavior and you get a shot of medication and maybe put in restraints. That's management, right? Understanding is like, why are you here today? Like, why are you asking for help? What's going on? Every single person is totally unique. Totally.
Why are you back here today?
Right. What's going on? You know, and when I trained, which was ages ago, mid to late 90s, right? I would say it was like 80% understanding, 20% management, which is astonishing because it's reversed now. You know,
yeah.
It's people are coming out of training and it's 80% management. And it just takes psychiatrists. How many psychiatrists are just like given a pill? Right? Like 80% management, 20% understanding. So when you're asking, like, if I could wave a magic wand, you know, and fix something, that's one thing, is that we would shift the emphasis back to understanding, being human with each other, engagement. Like, you're an engagement, you know, savant. Like, you know, like you're what you do in the world and your work is in the top echelon of engagement. And not everyone can reach that. But we can certainly do a lot better than we're doing. Then there is the rocket science stuff.
Yeah.
Which is like, how do you, you know, because what I'm trying to do in my leadership career is work within a system to bring the best care to the most people. The best care side is hard to balance with the most people side, right? So when I was at Silver Hill, you mentioned, which is a fantastic highly expert staff, and they provide excellent treatment to about 500 people a year, 600 people a year.
High cost for many, you know, for many of the programs they do, but they do great care.
Live in a world where, you know, insurance doesn't pay for this stuff the way it should. I hope in the next life we'll wake up.
Yeah,
and it's the opposite.
You know? I agree.
Where it gets paid for because it should. Where it's our brain and all that stuff. Where I work now, we do 500,000 outpatient visits a year. We do 100,000 inpatient days a year. We serve 30,000-40,000 people a year. So there's the access issue. This is more rocket science stuff. So what do we really have to do in the coming years so that we can treat, you know, of all the people that have mental illness, you know, I mean,
or substance use issues or both, right?
We're missing, you know, at least 50% of them. And substance use, we're missing even more. So we have to start thinking about innovation. We have to start thinking, and a lot of people are doing this. I don't think anyone's totally hit it out of the park yet, but there's virtual care in general. There's like app-based stuff. There's AI people are even thinking about, which is controversial, and I'm not sure how that's going to fit into things.
Yeah. And then I think we got to be careful with it, but yeah.
And I mean, you as the engagement expert, be interesting what you think about whether AI would ever substitute for connecting, you know, with a human.
I think it can make, you know, there's a part of the thing that you run into, and I mean, having worked with lots of clinicians and, you know, been in startup and managing programs, paperwork and documentation is just everybody's, you know, bugaboo. Chasing after people who need to document so you can get insurance billing or coding or any of those other kinds of things. I think there are administrative functions that exist within behavioral health care that AI can make simpler and easier and organize better, and can make people who are not always very good at that aspect of the care make their job easier, so they can really focus their attention on what you and I are talking about, which is the connection piece.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a piece of research out there that's fairly old, but it's still relevant, that, you know, it doesn't matter. The methodology that you use largely is not as impactful across methodologies as the therapeutic connection, as the therapeutic alliance that the care provider has with the person that they're serving. If the therapeutic alliance is strong, chances are good you're going to get pretty good outcomes with your care,
yeah.
Regardless of the method that you use. Now, you know, we got some pretty sophisticated methodologies in clinical work out there, including some technology that's helping us with the brain and all those other pieces, right? But I still think that it takes a person to connect with a person. They need to feel like they're not alone, and you can't just screen your way through to better mental health. It can be a tool, and it can be used, you know, daily meditation. You know, you've got somebody who's immediately available to you on a virtual platform that can respond to a text message or do a quick video meeting with you. Those are cool things. But I think that, and I'd like to get your idea about this, between insurance companies not paying for it and the stigma that exists both around mental health and addictions issues, you've got people don't seek care, right? You've got a lot of people who don't seek care. And then you, if you stack on top of that, the complement of there's a lot of care out there that is insufficient to the task. You know, people are getting, they're walking into a hospital, it's a revolving door, they're not getting the care they need because there's no management on the other side. There's no place for them to go.
Yeah.
So you end up with these very complicated conditions as a result of poor care done repeatedly.
Yep.
So you end up with this much greater need. Yeah. And I wonder if it's a matter of getting to everybody early enough before we get into this sticky wicket of complicated, didn't seek care for years and years and years, and now is a psychiatric condition they're having to go to the hospital for. Like, yeah, ideally they would have started managing this mental health much earlier. How do we get to that? Like, what's the path there?
Yeah, that's a great question. That goes on my rocket science list. And I don't mean to say rocket science, like it's really hard, but more just
operational. The systems issue, for sure.
Systems issue is a better way to say it. So there are a variety of ways to do that. Obviously, you know, working with kids and working on, you know, psychological resilience, right? Like, we always talk about the bad side of things. Like, when you have a mental illness, we talk about mental illness. We don't talk about mental health a lot, like, really. And there's some good programs out there where they're working with kids, even in college, like giving courses for credit that you can take on how to be psychologically resilient. But at scale, I would say, probably in my mind, one of the most impactful things is to get mental health into primary care, because everybody almost has a primary care provider, and they are overwhelmed. They're working super hard. They don't have a lot of time with patients. They need a lot of support. And I've been involved in my career in a variety, including where I am now. We have very robust integration into primary care. I did this when I was down in North Carolina as well. And one of the nice things about behavioral health into primary care, connecting them, is you can be virtual, right? So you can have, because, you know, person comes in to see their primary care doc, you can screen them. Even if you don't screen them, you know, the behavioral health team can get a report of all of the patients that are on psychiatric medications, for instance, and then they can reach out, hey, here's your behavioral health team, you know, just how's it going? And that doesn't have to be in person. It can be over video, it can be on the phone, it can be through the chart. And lots of studies show this, and this is consistent with when I've done it in systems. When you integrate behavioral health into primary care, first of all, your mental health outcomes are better. So generally, your depression scores fall and your anxiety scores fall, but also your medical conditions get better. You're in one.
That's right. Time they walk hand in hand.
Your A1Cs came down a full point for for the diabetic population. So it's good that you're onto that, because we're just seeing people downstream when they're falling out of the river down there. We should really look at them when they fall into the river, you know, way back
well,
upstream.
And you've got maybe a couple of years on me. Not a ton of years, but a couple of years on me. I can remember, and I've seen the shift, and I don't remember exactly when it was. I would say it's probably in the 2000s when you walk into the doc and they give you the sheet. It's like, where are you having problems? What's your thing today? Fill out this tick list of the conditions that you might have a history of or suffering from or concerned about. And the category that got added were psychiatric symptoms.
Yeah.
Depression, anxiety, are you having disturbed thoughts, or, you know, sleep, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a section that is there now that was not there very early on at the primary care physician's office, where you might list something where you're experiencing depressive symptoms or you're experiencing whatever it is that's in the psychiatric realm.
Yep.
And then they have to ask about it. Now they're still gun shy on treating you, or, you know, you're getting referred out often because it's not their wheelhouse. That's fair. I think that the other piece, and I'd like to hear the ways in which you're doing this now, because I know that you are, is, and when we go into concierge, when people go into concierge level care, especially with individuals who might be suffering from co-occurring medical conditions, co-occurring substance use, in addition to mental health, etc., you've got a team that's talking to one another.
Yeah.
And I think that the one of the things that the rest of the world experiences as a deficit is none of their providers talk to one another.
Yeah.
They're all expertly, you know, my favorite is expertly hitting expert tennis shots from separate courts.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, they're hitting into a, they don't have anybody to play off of.
Yeah.
And you're getting these siloed kinds of treatment results out of serving the greater public. And I wonder what the systems, you know, how are you seeing and how are you managing integrating the medical with the psychiatric, with the medication management, et cetera? Like, how is that happening for you there in Hartford?
Yeah. So a number of things. One is just very concretely, we're very lucky. We got about 60, 70 psychologists in our system, which is really unusual. You may know just the trends in the field for no good reason. When I trained, there were a lot of psychologists in big systems, even on inpatient units. And then over the subsequent 10, 20, 30 years, it changed. But we have a psychology department. We have a training program on health psychology. So we have about 30, you know, maybe even 40 psychologists that are embedded in medical practices. This is different than the integration into primary care. This is specialty practices. So this is, you know, liver transplant service. This is movement disorders. This is cancer. This is actually even orthopedics. We have like a psychologist that works in orthopedics. So there's a growing understanding that the mind, you know, plays a role in
huge role.
Weight loss, surgery, stuff like that. But at a more basic level, Todd, and this is the stuff that still, I want to say, bothers me a little bit, you know, like because I do the work and it is so fun. I would never want to do the work in isolation. It's no fun. Like it's much more fun to pick up the phone, which I do every time, and, you know, get a release and talk with the therapist and talk with the primary care doc and bring, by the way, the family in to the next.
I've gotten a couple of those calls.
Right. Well, I mean, and this to me, this is when it's my own failing that I haven't, you know, moved the needle further on this, maybe even nationally, because it seems so obvious to me. How can you do the work unless you're getting all that data, right? Because right now we don't have an MRI machine, but we are the MRI machine. So the more data you have, the more accurately you can figure out what's going on with someone. But it's just fun. It's challenging. to put things together. I mean, people come into us because they haven't been able to put things together and it's complicated, or else they wouldn't come in. So what we also do here, at least, is we emphasize it is a team sport. Like, the team-based care is a term you'll hear getting thrown around, but it is for real. And again, lots of studies show that team-based care is better care. So we do a lot of that as well.
I think that simple, you know, team-based care, it's simple. I mean, I think it leads to things that are profound in terms of quality of care.
Yeah.
But it's also something, the thing that carries people the most,
yeah,
whether it's professionals or in your on the ground workers or your direct care. I mean, the thing that carries people the most are these kind of simple things. It's like, I'm part of a team, or, you know, community is the solution, or there are these principles that kind of carry a person. Yeah. And I have the heart that wants to make it a national issue and solve the problem.
Yeah.
I have not yet accomplished that. I'm not going to saddle you with failure, and I'm not giving it up just yet either. So we're going to keep working, right? We're not giving up.
Well, I mean, because it just seems so obvious. You know, sometimes I think of us, I love, one of the reasons I went into the field is I love hanging out with clinicians. They're so, you learn from every one of them. You know, everyone does things a little bit differently. They have different methods or tricks, you know, in a sense, in how to engage with people. And one of the things that is really impactful is case conferences, which is something I always bring in wherever I am. They used to be around 30 years ago. Not so much anymore, all this productivity stuff. And also bringing the patient into that, right?
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And it's always impactful to the patient. First of all, see all these caring, smart people that care about them, that are putting their heads together to try to figure out what's going on with them. And then you learn stuff, you know, from each other. One of the other things I'm doing is we have two times this year, once at a big conference that we had on patient experience. And then one recently, we had a summit for our interns. We have like a social work interns. And there's a particular patient of mine I've been working with for 2 years who struggles with a lot of really tough stuff. And she's extraordinarily bright and articulate and really wants to give back. She's always, like, when she gets hospitalized, you know, you can bring residents and interns in and she'll talk with them about what's going on with her. Mm. And so I've had a conversation with her at the big conference, right, with all kinds of administrators and everything that have never seen a psychiatric interview. And then we were invited to go to this intern. So what it does, first of all, it normalizes talking with patients. And when I say patients, I mean a human being who's in the patient
shocking concept,
role.
Really.
Well, it's just someone in the patient role. In that sense, I'm in the doctor role, but that could switch. I mean, we're all patients at some point. So it normalizes it. It's also like, I think of us, and I don't know if this makes any sense to you, but like, you know, when I look at the work that our people do, including you, I'm like, these are like star athletes. It's imagine we were like a professional, we were playing like professional baseball, right? Like, that's how good people are at this. And yet we rarely get to see each other do it, you know, to get inspired by it, to learn things, to actually even critique each other too at times. Like, yeah, I don't know, like should I?
You might want to consider this or do it this way, or I've done it this, yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, which is just, I mean, the value in that. I mean, to me, just the opportunity, even with the show, that's part of what the show is about, actually. It's like getting with people like you and just, you know, let's take 30 or 40 minutes and just hear this person's wisdom of decades worth of care.
Yeah.
And I don't think people understand the value of it. And the fact that, you know, in many ways, somebody like you with as many credentials as you have and all the things hanging on the wall and everything else, I think one thing that people might not know at first glance is that you're also like this really nice person that's fun to hang out with.
Well, I mean, it's not right.
I think, you know, that's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, to me, part of that is, you know, it's not rocket science. I grew up working in a fish market. This is not, and partly I say that for people to know that you can learn this stuff. Like, I still literally use lines from when I was in training, and I used to observe the way that people would, we'd had a lot of that back in the day. You would observe how people interview. And I still literally use lines today. I have a couple of them come to mind that are really good. One is, especially with somebody that is kind of depressed, it's what keeps you going?
Yeah.
Like a very simple, you know, it's a very simple, and there's usually only a few categories of things, you know, or you don't get an answer. You know, or another one is, do you have anyone out there you can lean on? Right. Literally, like I heard that 30 years ago and I've used it every year. Well,
you've got techniques like motivational interviewing and all these things. I'm like, hey, you know, a lot of this is Socratic method. You know what I mean? Like it's Socratic method that's been distilled and refined and everything else. But asking somebody a good question that causes them to focus on, what are the resources you have? Like, how are you keeping yourself well?
Right.
They have an impact on, you know, as opposed to, you know, are you feeling terrible? Have you had any suicidal thoughts? I mean, those can be important questions, and I'm not discounting them.
Right.
Having a person focus on the ways in which they're maintaining a well-being,
right,
it is a shift I think many of our, provider networks need to make a little
bit. Yeah. And I think our folks don't get nearly enough credit for what they do. They you know, and to make it perverse, like they get a lot of attention when something goes wrong, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But no one gets how incredible, like, and it's a little bit of what we do is sort of like a trade. It's like becoming a really good plumber. Like, you know, I think you said you have to apprentice, you know, and watch people and get better at and make some mistakes too. You know, like that's how, you know, you learn. But I want to get back to stigma because you did use that word, and I don't want to, I know we don't have too much time left, and I want to, I think that's critical. I mean, that would be the other thing if I could wave a magic wand is there is so much stigma still. I mean, the good news is the younger generations, I think, are doing better, but it is embedded in a lot of what we do. It's embedded in our systems and, you know, to give a shout out to the system I'm in. And I've all my places have been good. I mean, they've had great luck in finding good places to work. But as big systems go, again, this is, you know, it's a 47,000 person, $7 billion not-for-profit system, which these days is not huge. Behavioral health is big here, but it's not as big as the rest of what we do, right? We have acute care hospitals and orthopedics and surgery and primary care and emergency rooms, right? But one of the reasons I'm still here after more than six years is that there is less stigma here around mental health than I've ever seen in any other system. And I think that's a function of the culture, you know, of an organization. And the culture of our organization, they've been working on it for 15 years officially. You know, they really work hard on it. We have leadership behaviors, and including be curious, not judgmental.
Oh, yeah.
Not judgmental. That's literally a leadership behavior. And so you had mentioned this program that we started, and I do want to, you know, let people know about it, not only because it's a great program. It's called the Ridge Recovery Center. It's in northeastern Connecticut.
Opened last year, is that right?
Exactly a year ago. In fact, we had just had an event, 1 year event, and two of the former patients that came were one of them was the first patient.
Oh, wow.
The other one was like the fifth patient or something. And they told their stories of recovery, you know? What's extraordinary about this program, which shouldn't be extraordinary, but it is that, and you know the field well, so there's a lot of small private, you know, residential rehab. So it's like 60 beds, and we've got some are withdrawal management, or we used to call them detox. Some are residential rehab, and then a few of them are extended stay. You can, it's like a sober living kind of thing. So most of the, a lot of the people that do that do them in small private organizations, which, you know, to make a living, to make it work, to sustain a place, it has to be out of pocket. This is not that way. This is insurance based, and it's part of a large health system. And the fact that a health system during the pandemic, you know how bad that was for health systems. I mean, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars lost, billions really, in, across the country. During that period, our system invested in starting this program, which is, you know, again, like it's sort of a heart.